national sports figure recently was convicted of running dog fights and various other forms of abuse, and various damage control measures were put in place and certain denials were given, but eventually he did admit his guilt. I was pulling into the post office this last week, had the radio on, the news came on, and they had a copy of him presenting his apology basically to his fans and to the team and to the people who knew him. In his apology, he says, "I take full responsibility for my actions." And then he said, "I'm going to have to grow up." Seems strange to see that terminology used. I mean, that's what we say to a child, you know, grow up. Act your age. Don't be so childish. But he actually just said to the world, because many were listening, says, "I'm going to have to grow up." Effectively, I'm going to have to become more emotionally mature. I thought that was a significant way to at least state that point. I remember listening to Dr. Laura's program one time, again, driving around on errands, one thing or another, and a lady came on and began to complain about her husband and his childish ways. And the lady began to, finally she said, "He's going to have to choose to put on his big boy pants." Well, who do you think Dr. Laura took after at that point? If you've listened to her program, she lit into the lady who was calling. She said, "You married a child. He's still a child. You married him that way. What is it about you that made you want to be married to a child?" And so the lady, now complaining about her husband needing to put on his big boy pants, had to put on the big girl's dress, I suppose, in the course of the program. But Dr. Laura just lit into her right away. You know, marriage is not for spiritually and emotionally immature people. Rick and Lisa are getting married tomorrow. They've counseled for marriage. I had the opportunity to sit and counsel with them a number of times. And the two things that I try to, if I'm working with a couple as they prepare for marriage, that I try to address is, one, spiritual commitment, and two, emotional maturity. In marriage counseling, I want to help people as much as possible, yes, infer, see that they have their commitments in place before God, but I want them, I say, I want you to walk into this marriage with your eyes open. I want them to see each other as clearly as possible, and I also want to help them to clearly see themselves. I have refused to marry members of the church who came to me asking if I would perform their wedding on two occasions. On both occasions, I felt, because of emotional issues and circumstances and finances and other matters, that they simply were not ready to commit to marriage in that way. I pleaded in both cases to give me the time to try to walk them through some steps to make this more evident and to prepare themselves more for the commitment they were wanting to make. Both couples refused that request. Both couples married anyway, and both couples ended up divorcing. The two times that I have said, "No, I simply cannot in good conscience bind you together before God," the couples married and ended up divorcing, in one case within 6 months. One time, a young lady who had grown up in the church and had ceased to attend, but was still very friendly and pleasant in relationship, her parents attending the church, called me and asked me if I would perform her wedding. And I asked her a few questions about her circumstances, and I said, "Are you living with the man that you're planning to marry?" And she says, "Yes." I said, "I cannot do that." I said, "I will have to counsel you, but before I can counsel you, you have to separate your lives and live conscientiously." I said, "I'm going to marry you before God." And she says, "I am not a bad person." And that was the end of our relationship. Quite frankly, it was the end of my relationship with her parents as well, even though they were still attending church at that time. Marriage is a very high level of commitment. It is a matter truly of putting God first before the marriage and being emotionally mature in terms of the relationship and the and the ability to maintain that relationship in the course of time. 1 Corinthians 7, I do want to at least clearly make one statement here in addressing the covenant that is made, the importance of it, and then I want to really spend the more majority part of the time today addressing the emotional maturity, the basis in terms of the relationship that goes beyond just simply our worship of God. But in a matter has come up recently in Nigeria, marrying outside of the faith is a big issue in Nigeria. The entire church there is 150 people. I've mentioned this before. Some of those are old people. Some of those are young, very young children. And there are the young adults in between. And yet, it is still a commitment to put God first. And so in the course of ongoing matters that will come up, somebody will come and all of a sudden there is a friend, and it's just a social friend, but it turns out it's not a social friend. It's a boyfriend or a girlfriend. In fact, we would like to get married, and only one of us is in the church. 1 Corinthians 7, verse 39, make no mistake, the Bible is not in dispute on this matter. A wife is bound by law as long as her husband lives. But if her husband dies, she is at liberty to be married to whom she wishes, only in the Lord. Now, to argue that it only applies after a death in terms of having to marry in the church is simply not true. In principle, it is important that we understand that that is the only way that we can marry and still put God first. I want to read you just a little bit of a comment from recent memo Mr. Keller sent. I asked him if I could quote from it, and he said that would be fine. He talks about his own preparation for marriage back when he was in college. He said, before I married, I made a list of things I insisted on having in a wife. Sounds a little male, doesn't it? Here's what I have to have in a wife. Okay, but look at what it was that he had to have. He says, the first and most important was that she be very converted. I guess we could ask for that either way, one of the other, could we not? I don't mean baptized, I mean very converted. There's all kinds of people who sit in the Church of God and have been baptized, frankly, who are unfruitful, at least by appearance. Very converted. It's hard to know someone truly well until you're with them daily, but I tried. I felt Lucretia was very converted, and I spoke to her about it seriously and asked probing questions. I told her that I intended to only marry someone who was very converted, would put God before herself, before me, in fact, before all things. She sincerely agreed that she didn't want to marry anyone who wasn't very converted, that we must always put God and His wishes first. You cannot put God first and ignore the instruction of the Bible to marry within the faith. He said, had I not been able to find someone that was very converted, my plan was to not marry at all. There are many in the Bible who never married, including Jesus. There are eunuchs who have made themselves eunuchs for the kingdom of heaven's sake. Pretty strong, but it is absolutely biblical. He says, when I have counseled single people for baptism, I have pointedly asked them if they understood that they could only marry a believer and made them state that they were committed to only marry a believer, even if that meant never marrying at all. He says, I cannot imagine any circumstance where I would be the one unequally yoking a believer to a non-believer. Non-believer doesn't mean a person who is a bad person. It means a person who has not yet been called, not yet been responsive to that in baptism, made covenant with God, and received the Holy Spirit. That's what it means. It's an interesting circumstance. I had an opportunity to baptize Lisa. Lisa is, how can I say that? She's a little older than a spring chicken. And Lisa knew in her life, in the approximate age that she is, she knew that, you know, she wasn't 18 or 22 or 24. I don't know if I want to carry this too far, but Lisa knew that the possibility existed that if she was baptized and made this kind of commitment, because I also asked her exactly this kind of question, and if she could not have said, no, indeed, I will put God first, I could not have in good conscience baptized her at all. And she told me. I didn't ask her if I could share this. I don't believe it's that confidential. It's the commitment that everyone surely would want to make. She said, I counted the cost in baptism that it is possible that I would never marry at all. Now, God has blessed her greatly and blessed Rick greatly, and they'll be married tomorrow. And they have both chosen in that respect to put God first. Spiritual commitment is important. There is no compromise for that. There is no second place. To be unequally yoked, I think, sometimes is misunderstood. The converted person is not better in that sense than an unconverted person. The converted person is not even necessarily more emotionally mature than an unconverted person. Being converted means to be called of God, again, having made covenant with God in baptism, and making a commitment that God must come first. Being emotionally mature is an important factor in that, because it means to be able to process a relationship in an honest and honorable manner. But there is no guarantee, even with a converted person, that emotional maturity is actually in place. And that's what I wanted to bring today in respect. I have a handout that was passed out here. Some of them should have been passed out in Post Falls as well. The handout is not your spiritual guide to emotional maturity. The handout is because there were so many points under the study that had been done by Dwight Dean literally decades ago that I felt it would be easier for you to at least have it in your hand. And I left it in his words and his form so that I could at least sign his name to it. But there's enough material in this handout that is good and solid that I would like to, at least in the course of my sermon today, pull from it and address to each of us what emotional maturity really is. So the handout is simply to help you follow as I go through these subjects. And again, it is in Dwight Dean's words out of a book that he wrote that was made available, frankly, some decades ago. Again, the list is complete the way he wrote it. I would have ordered some of the listings under each of the topics differently myself. Some of the listings actually repeat themselves. Some of the listings come in a social context. Our context is the kingdom of God. Our context is Christ is the head of the church. So I want to at least offer that as I begin to go through and address some of these things. The first thing on the list was stress tolerance. Think of these things in terms of the emotional maturity that is required for a person to be able to be responsive to God our Father and our Lord Jesus Christ. To be able to be responsive one to another. It says love one another. You know, Christ said that they would love one another. That's the proof that they are my disciples. How is love expressed? Love is expressed in a relationship. Love is expressed when we turn the other cheek, when we show consideration, when we put each other first, when we submit ourselves one to another. I can read all those scriptures, but sometimes we've heard those scriptures enough to where they sound rote to us, and it helps to break it down into maybe some more specific points. How does a person who is emotionally mature handle stress? Now, again, Dwight Dean's words, I think this will, to one degree or another, put a certain amount of pressure on most all of us. But it says, a mature person does not worry needlessly, okay? Remains cheerful even when things aren't going his way. What a great sermonette. Talk about the blessing of the joy that we should have as an evidence to the world that we are God's people, to rejoice before God and man as well. Live calmly rather than frequently having the jitters. Now, I had actually crossed out the one about relieving tension with well-placed humor, not because I don't agree, but because everybody processes in a little bit different way, but I gave a sermon once, to live life on the bright side, I think we should try. And I think humor in various respects does lighten our load. And it produces, it encourages a very positive chemical process even in the body. And there's a lot of evidence of that. How does a mature person handle anger? Well, different than some of us, surely, would we not have to say. Some of us, me. I have to sign on with this as well. But he says the mature person, when disappointed, refuses to give in to sulking into sorrow that deepens further and sorrow into depression. The mature person, when frustrated, reacts constructively rather than harboring resentment. I went to Costco some time back with Derek, and Costco had a new credit card. And it was an upgrade credit card, and they take it right over the computer, they take your name, and they just give you the next one up, and they can tell you right there if it's ready or not. And we're buying Derek's laptop computer for his college that we had saved for, and so I wanted the credit for that on this new system. So I asked about it, and the person there at the counter began to describe, and I said, but I need an answer right now. And she said, well, maybe you want to call them yourself. So I called them myself. She hands me the phone and gives me all this information. And what it ended up in is it put me at the end of a very, very long line on the phone in terms of the program and how you get a credit card, and you're the last person that's going to get response on earth. Now, Costco has a little computer right there. All you push in, they got the records, everything's input, and they get an answer right back on the computer. When I found out, after I was done talking to the man, I found out that the lady should have simply offered to do it for me behind the counter and it would have been done, and I didn't realize it, so I tried to cancel, which you couldn't, it's gone, it's over. And then I started to get upset. I didn't get upset with the lady because she said, it's your own fault, you know, you asked for it, this is what you wanted. I go, is it legal to reach across the counter and grab this person, you know? So I just sat there and I walked away. Well, Derek's kind of laid back. Derek's like, leave it alone, drop it, it's no big deal. And I'm, and he just kept telling me, he says, you know, it's nothing, you know, who cares, you know, so what? You know, I said, but you don't understand, this is a problem, you know, this is, and we just went through this whole process, and I'd be quiet for a while, and then I'd think about it, and then it upset me again, and I'd go, well, I guess on this I'm not that mature. It says reacts constructively. In other words, you do something that is going to resolve the matter, but you don't harbor the resentment, because why? It makes you sick. It makes everybody else sick. And so, yesterday in the mail came this credit card floating through, and it was only, you know, a month down the road or 5 or 6 weeks, whatever it was, and I thought, and I looked at the card, and Michelle's got one, I got one, I set them on the desk, and I said, you know, what was the big deal? Who cares? You know, I care. But I got to think back. I said it wasn't indeed what God intended. Spiritual maturity is important. How we handle the stresses and the angers and frustrations of our lives has an impact that is significant. It says here, when angered by superiors, does not take it out on, and we could just say other individuals. There shouldn't be a backlash when we have a bad day on everybody else around us, because that's immaturity in an emotional sense. Reaction to authority. It says the mature person doesn't resent reasonable rules and regulations. He complies with reasonable requests cheerfully. Doesn't avoid unpleasant but necessary tasks. Takes responsibility, doesn't have to be wrestled into position to fulfill and carry his own weight. It's emotional maturity. It's not what a child does, but some children never grow up. And some of us sit right down in the Church of God, and we have yet to emotionally mature. And it boils out of our relationships, our marriages, our service, our attitude and approach, and it becomes evident in various ways to those around us. Integration talks about, well, how does this all then get implemented? What does it mean now to put it in place? It says the mature person has a clearly defined philosophy of life. Okay. Now we're doing something that we could say, I could do that. We have a clearly defined philosophy of life, do we not? Have clearly defined sense of purpose. And then it says, seems emotionally secure. Because if you have a clearly defined philosophy of life, this is how we will live our life in this way, and we have a sense of purpose, life has meaning, therefore, that should give us a sense of worth and value and purpose in this life, spiritually, for us. And there should be a sense of security that flows with it. Now, that's very interesting because it was a story that I was trying to find for my last week's sermon, and I couldn't find it in my notes in the car. And it's a good thing because I found it for this week's sermon, and it actually fits better today than the last. But it's a journalist. Goes back to, again, that same magazine I was reading out of the week that I quoted from. But he says that I got the story, but I lost my faith. And it was a story about a journalist who landed a job covering religion for the Los Angeles Times. And that was his dream come true because he was a religious man. He felt it was a gift from God. He says, when the editors of the Los Angeles Times assigned me to the religion beat 9 years ago, I believed God had answered my prayers. As a serious Christian, I had cringed at some of the coverage of religion in the mainstream media. Faith frequently was treated like a circus, even a freak show, and I wanted instead to report objectively and respectfully about how belief shapes people's lives. Along the way, I believed my own faith would grow deeper and sturdier. Said something very different happened. He begins to pour out how he began to follow some of the Catholic clergy sex scandals. He began to research areas where dioceses had taken the priests and simply shipped them to another diocese unknown, and then more sex abuse happened and they shipped them to another place as well. He began to go through and document the places where they were protected and the places where those who were abused were defended against in order to not have to assist them. And it goes through a list of names and circumstances, which I've chosen. There's no purpose for me to mention that. Then he goes through a list where he begins to report on various stories among the Mormon church and congregations and some of the issues that took place and what happened to the people that were cast out of their congregations and the relationships that followed. And he documents all the way down through that. And it, again, he follows through it fairly long. He was a Catholic himself. Finally, he says, on Good Friday, 2002, I decided I couldn't belong to the Catholic Church any longer. Though I spent a year preparing for it, I didn't go through with the rite of conversion. He says, a few months later, I stopped attending church altogether. But he's still on the news beat covering religion for the Times, for the Los Angeles Times. He said, so I began looking into the Trinity Broadcasting Network. Now, again, I'm reading you what he said. I'm not trying to poke holes at one group versus another group. These are the examples that he gave. And he starts to follow the money trail and where the money's coming in from and the prosperity gospel and what the promises that were being made to the people if they would give the money and then where the money went and the houses and the planes and the various benefits that accrued to some of the leaders. And then he says, you know, I began to consider the possibility that God doesn't even exist. Now, he started out wanting to think of this and seeing it as a gift of God, and he dives in and begins to report on religion. Then he stops attending church. Then he says he begins to consider the possibility that God doesn't even exist. He said, finally, in the summer of 2005, I reported from a Portland, Oregon courtroom about an unemployed mother impregnated by a seminary student 13 years earlier trying to get increased child support for a sickly 12-year-old son. And he goes through the long tragedy of the defense again by the church in this case against the individual and how the judge in the end actually ruled for the church against the support for the child. He said, my problem was that none of that surprised me anymore. As I walked into the long twilight of a Portland summer evening, I felt numb. My soul, for lack of a better term, had lost faith long ago. My brain, which had been in denial, had finally caught up. Sitting in the park across the street from the courthouse, I called my wife on a cell phone, told her I was putting in for a new beat at the paper. You know, just it was such a tragic story to say, here's somebody that goes out and begins to look around into the details of the religion and the lives and the personal issues that take place. And he stops his faith, he stops attending, he begins to question if God even exists, and finally he just washes his hands and wanted nothing more to do with it at all. A mature person has a clearly defined philosophy of life and a clearly defined sense of purpose, and you cannot lose it. It is what defines the meaning for us and why we do the things we do day by day. And it buys us security and peace. And we cannot look at man, man's deeds, man's decision, because God said we put God first. Man will fail us, and we will sometimes fail each other. But that should not shake our faith and our conviction in what we understand our purpose to be. There has to be something that we hold on to, even when everything else falls apart around us in that way. I'd like to go back to the book of Daniel. Because Daniel, all these great stories, and we read them to our children, and we read them in Sabbath school, and they're glorious stories because they're so dramatic. But let's go back and just reread one of the stories, Daniel 3, verse number 8, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Now, I know we know the story, but let's just try to absorb it again just a little bit, because here we have individuals who had a clear philosophy of life, a clear defined sense of purpose, and what did it allow them to do? It allowed them to not lose faith, to not be destroyed and cast off on the side when something threatened their opportunities in this life. There was accusation that was made here. It says, at a certain time, that time, certain Chaldeans came forward and accused the Jews. They spoke and said to King Nebuchadnezzar, O king, live forever. You, O king, have made a decree that everyone who hears the sound of the horn, flute, harp, lyre, psaltery, and symphony with all kinds of music shall fall down and worship the gold image. I mean, this is way beyond simply having to show up for work on the Sabbath and saying, I cannot do that. And whoever does not fall down and worship will be cast in the midst of a burning fiery furnace. There are certain Jews whom you set over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men, O king, have not paid due regard to you. They do not serve your gods or worship the gold image that you have set up. Then Nebuchadnezzar, in rage and fury, gave the command to bring Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and they brought the men before the king. Nebuchadnezzar spoke, saying to them, Is it true, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the gold image that I have set up? And now if you're ready at the time you hear the sound of the horn, the flute, harp, psaltery, the music, and all the symphony, and you fall down and worship the image that I've made, he says, good. But if you don't worship, you'll be cast immediately in the midst of a burning fiery furnace. Who is the God who will deliver you from my hands? Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king Nebuchadnezzar, We have no need to answer you in the matter. We don't have to think about it. We don't have to go pray and fast about it. We're simply going to do what we know to be true. If that is the case, our God, whom we serve, is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us from your hand, O king. But if not, let it be known to you that we do not serve your gods. We will not worship the gold image that you have set up. Didn't matter. Had to send a memo off this week. So if you're making a decision, make a decision based on what is right and what is wrong without any consequences at all. I said, then after you make your decision, then you evaluate the consequences. I said, consequences do matter. So you do evaluate the consequences of the decision. But I said, most of the time, the consequences will only make a compromise to be made. So you have to make the decision on the purity of it. Going back to the example I gave to start with, you never marry outside the faith. Therefore, you don't build a relationship, and you don't date outside the faith, because you build a basis for which there can be no fulfillment without a compromise. And yet when the time comes, it seems like such a heavy, heavy burden to bear. Mr. Keller said, I had determined in my mind that I would either be able to marry someone who was deeply converted and committed to God, or I would remain single in this flesh. And I just thought, what a remarkable position to take. Going back to emotional maturity, go back to what says self-control. Again, I left that handout intact because of the author who had actually put it together. I would write it a little bit differently, and so I'm trying to adjust for that a bit as I teach. But self-control. A mature person does not seek special privileges for themselves. A mature person is not presumptuous, which means to assume that there will be benefit or needs met of his own at the expense of others. A mature person does not blame others for undesirable consequences of his own. If you do something and it causes a problem and there are consequences, it is your own fault. It is my fault. It is our fault. But we cannot blame someone else. You take ownership. A child will give excuses oftentimes. A person who is emotionally mature will not. Will not. They'll take ownership of the impact and the effects of the decisions they have made. Again, one of the things that has, we were joking about it on our backpacking trip, because I have said at various times that pain is our friend. And I mean it in the sense that pain will sometimes cause us to do things that need to be done that would not be done otherwise, because it is the consequences of the choices that we have made. But the fact is, when you tell someone who has made a decision that has brought pain, if you respond and say, well, pain is our friend, then probably you are not their friend at that time. The fact is, we have to be willing to take ownership. An emotionally mature person will. Matters of judgment. A mature person seeks facts before making decisions. He who hears a matter first, he was first in a matter, seems right. Is that not true? Does that not seem right until you hear the consequence of it? Can I tell you how many times in the course of marriage counseling where accusation is brought against one mate by the other to me, where something was done, something was said, and it sounds terrible until you ask the other individual and you hear the rest of the story, as Paul Harvey said, and pretty soon it's unbelievable, and the question will sometimes come up, well, is anybody right in this matter? If there isn't one person who's right, then what do you do? How do you decide? If everybody is wrong, then who wins? A mature person faces the inevitabilities of life, such as illness and loss of job, with calmness. Acceptance, not because it's pleasant, but because it's reality. And goes forward in that respect. Guy Muller is dying. He has a hard time taking nutrition. He missed Sabbath last week. He was feeling better this week. I assume he's on now in Post Falls. I hope he's there. But he's dying. And he knows it. And he accepts it. And we pray for God's will and God's mercy. And he's a friend of mine in a personal way, and my family, and of the church. And as this plays out, it's going to be a real loss. But you know what? And I know, again, guys that are listening, I know guys got tears in both eyes right now. But he accepts the consequences and circumstances in his life, and he's grateful for the great blessings that he's had, that he's received. I think it's an honor and an example for all of us. A mature person postpones immediate gratification in favor of long-range goals. Boy, is that a big one. I mentioned in a sermon one time of an experiment that was done with children where they offered them some candy or a toy. Or if they would wait, they could get like twice as much a little bit later. And they took the children that couldn't wait that wouldn't wait to get twice as much. And then they tracked them, and they tracked their life and the failures in their life and the delinquency and the trouble and the consequence. It was just like a meter that told them exactly where that child was going. The children who said, I will wait a little bit and get twice as much, they tracked, and they were better academically in school, they were better in the jobs that they attained, they were better in their relationships, they simply had a willingness to forego immediate gratification at least a little tiny bit. At least a little tiny bit. Proverbs 25. Verse 16. Have you found honey? Eat only as much as you need, lest you be filled with it and vomit. Eat only as much as you need. 27. It is not good to eat much honey, so to seek one's own glory is not glory. To seek your own recognition, to seek your own way. Whoever has no rule over his own spirit. Now this is tied directly to eating too much honey, receiving a blessing, and wanting it all now. If you can't control your emotion, your thought, your spirit, your desire. I'm not talking about weakness that we've repent of and God forgives us by the blood of Jesus Christ. Talking about the inability to continue to strive to put God first and His ways and the principles that flow from it. If you have no rule over your own spirit, it's like a city broken down without walls. There's no defense. Anything that's placed before you, we're going to grab it and run the other way. So it's in that context. It's in the context of being willing to postpone immediate gratification for our long-range goals. There are people who are unable to save second tithe, not because the money doesn't come in, but because there's always a crisis this week, and this money is in my hand, and therefore I'm going to use it to meet the crisis, and they never receive the intervention and blessing of God in that way. They never do. The crisis never goes away. The finances never improve. And you know what? They don't get to go to the feast, because when the time comes, they are unable. It is important that we do it the way God said. Everything, as much as possible, do it the way God said. Michelle actually had gone through a file that we have, some of the things of the year she's put in there, some of it I've put in there on marriage, and she was doing research, and she pulled a couple of things out, and again, one of them was the emotional maturity list, and I looked at it, and it was of interest, and another one was an article here on self-governance. It's about what needs to take place before somebody makes a commitment to marriage. Again, it's in that context. Now notice this. It's written by T.O. Yeats. I don't know who T.O. Yeats is, but you know, I could go find him, I suppose, but then if I told you and he did this for some company and he lived there, I don't think that'll change it, because I'm talking about what he wrote and on the value of the material itself. It says, every person considering marriage should consider a period of no less than 2 years of self-governance as a prerequisite to marriage. One of its chief purposes is to determine whether one can find happiness within oneself, being fully responsible for every important area of living. This means supporting oneself financially and satisfactorily and managing a budget. The point is, if you are not happy as a single, don't even imagine you're going to be happy as a married person in a relationship that has far greater stakes. If you're a failure as a single, then that's not the time to get married. It says here, take the 2 years, take responsibility for your finances, your upkeep, your maintenance, and show that you can be successful and happy where you are first, before you go forward. Coming to enjoy one's own company in independent living is essential. This includes liking yourself, finding satisfying interests outside of job or school, meeting and enjoying a company of a number of new people whose ages range widely while remaining emotionally independent of them. Self-governance includes being responsible for selecting your living space, arranging it to suit you, keeping it clean and maintained in good repair. Self-governance involves preparing your own well-balanced meals, selecting, cleaning, maintaining your clothes, attending to your spiritual growth. There's nothing wrong with what this man has said. In fact, it's excellent. Only when you know that you can be happy as a completely self-responsible, independent person can you be ready for a potentially successful marriage. A marriage involving even one irresponsible person has two strikes against success. Marriage cannot cure deficiencies that lie within oneself. You must work out your happiness alone before you can logically expect happiness in marriage. I think that is profound. Who wants to marry someone whose life is a failure and then hope for success? It's simply saying you have to be able to be self-sufficient and content and successful first by yourself before you then bind yourself to someone else. Again, I think that is absolutely profound. On the emotional maturity list, again, going back, man-woman relationships. A mature person has many friends of both sexes. A mature person views sex as a natural and respected aspect of a whole person's life, obviously in marriage, obviously, has friendships with the opposite sex, not mainly based on physical attraction, just wholesome, positive relationships. There's two here, on one attitude toward learning and one intellectual maturity. It says, listens respectfully to those of differing opinions. Disciplines self when necessary to spend more time on difficult subjects. Doesn't just take the easy way. Enjoys investigating, challenging new fields of interest. Wants to learn and grow and understand. The mature person is humble in the knowledge that he has. You know, we had Ambassador College, which was a liberal arts educational institution. And the concept was it was important for a person to know some history and to know some of the arts and the literature and to have math and science and economics and various things and religion, obviously theology. But it was important to have a broad basis of perspective in order to be successful in this life. A mature person enjoys learning, enjoys it, seeks out learning, wants to understand. What have you learned lately? Megan and Derek came back from Nigeria, and they both had to write a little article back to Dari and put it on the website. Megan's is gone. Derek's is on my desk. It'll go out probably this weekend. But I told them they have to. Dari asked them. All the youth corps members had to say, write up a little article. What did you learn from this trip? What were the lessons? What would you want to learn in the future? How are you going to apply the lessons that you did learn? Megan wrote an article basically showing that some of the hardest times are some of the best times when you successfully complete them. And she went to that rope bridge that I described, and I was just sheets of rain coming down, and everybody started singing back and forth and chanting, and nobody backed off. And we completed the activity, and it was the high point of the camp. It was one of the harder times. Derek went to the time when the road had flooded over in the river, and we were sitting there, and there were cars trying to go through. One of our cars had flooded out, and we had to push it back through. The police came through. No villager would help the police. The staff members pushed the police car down the road into a dry area, came back up to the flooded area. There were motorcycles trying to get through and couldn't. It was staff members took and pushed the motorcycle up through the flood, all the way through. It was 100 yards, 150 yards, wrestling the water, got him on the other side, and he took off on his way. It was members there of our group that turned and picked up the tomatoes and the peppers and the things that had lain on the side of the road and been washed off into the woods. The people who were there from the camp were just going around saying, who can we help? Strangers, people we had no knowledge of, we would never see again in this life. And it was obvious, and so Derek wrote this article on the importance of helping strangers. because he saw that it was the church people who tried to help everybody else. And a lot of the other people, fine, if you needed something, maybe you could ask them, but they stood around and watched and kind of let things just kind of happen and go on their way. It's important that we learn lessons, that we seek out lessons, that we be educated. Proverbs chapter 1, opening to the book on wisdom and knowledge, says, "The Proverbs of Solomon, the son of David, king of Israel, to know wisdom and instruction, to perceive the words of understanding, to receive the instruction of wisdom, justice, judgment, and equity, to give prudence to the simple, to the young man knowledge and discretion. A wise man will hear and increase learning, and a man of understanding will attain wise counsel. To understand a proverb, an enigma, the words of the wise, and the riddles. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge, but fools despise wisdom and instruction." Responsibility. Again, going back to the list. A mature person willingly assumes the normal chores required in day-to-day living. He can be counted on to do what he promises. A mature person plans his time and adapts accordingly, as is necessary, and he does his fair share of the work in the organization to which he belongs. In the church, he puts his shoulder to the wheel. Clearly. Communication. A mature person enjoys and can maintain conversation of a serious nature. Everything isn't just a joke. Everything isn't just funny. Everything isn't just passing by. A mature person is able to communicate adequately with logical background and tell why he feels a certain way, can express himself. He's a good listener. A mature person shares ideas with others rather than just monopolizing the conversation. Talks about security and insecurity. So the mature person is tolerant of others, yet stands up for his own beliefs. He doesn't find it difficult to accept those who don't share his ideas. And we're talking socially here. We're not talking the beast. Okay, we're in the context of a social interaction. A mature person can admit mistakes to others readily. A mature person never gossips about others. Why? Because gossip means to put someone down in order to lift yourself up. When we gossip and put someone down, it is a desire to seek elevation of our own. Proverbs 11, verse number 12. "He who is devoid of wisdom despises his neighbor and talks down about him. But a man of understanding holds his peace." So we're talking about now speech. Openly stated. "A talebearer reveals secrets, but he who is a faithful spirit conceals a matter," reduces it, covers it. Now, I'm not talking about, sorry, the bank's robbed, I know who did it, but I'm not going to tell you. We're not on that scale. We're talking about gossip. We're talking about pain. We were talking on the way down today, there was a Teen USA pageant or something recently. One of the contestants got on there and they asked her a question about education, and the poor girl must have had a mental block, and she babbled on and on and talked about South Africa and wandered back and forth, and the sentences weren't even complete, and she came back and finally stopped talking after a time, and she never answered the question. Now, I'm telling you, she's not there because she can't even speak. She just had a bad moment. Her brain went blank. Something happened under stress. They played it on the talk shows across this nation, coast to coast. That girl emotionally is probably ruined. I felt terrible as they were playing that. It was just a mistake. And it made national play. It is unbelievable. It says, "He was a faithful spirit, conceals a matter." Someone who's emotionally mature probably couldn't even have a talk show. Proverbs 16, verse number 27. "An ungodly man digs up evil, and it is on his lips like a burning fire." Just can't wait to say something about it. Just can't wait to write it in a book and see if we can sell some books and get some money. "A perverse man sows strife, and a whisper separates the best of friends." They are an enemy to the unity and to the peace of a society. Social poise. A mature person is able to converse readily with people, to converse with people they've met for the first time. They can speak or read to a large group without stumbling or faltering because their focus is not on themselves. The reason we stumble and falter is because we're self-conscious. We're self-conscious because the focus is on ourselves. Does that mean we've never had a problem with that? No, we've all had a problem with that. It's talking about what maturity really would be. A mature person feels at ease with people of any age and makes social introductions easily. So what it comes down to, again, the basic dynamic is there is self, that's Satan, and there is love, there's outgoing concern, that's being concerned for others. When Jesus Christ prayed, "Your will be done," it was the antithesis of Satan's approach, which is, "I want my own. This is all about me. I will raise myself up. I will sit as the Most High." I gave the sermon last week. I mentioned, let me find my little handout here. I mentioned the circumstance in the tennis world. Wouldn't you know, so far I haven't even found it. I will, one moment, here it is. I mentioned an article on Jennifer Capriati and the struggle she was having emotionally after being injured in tennis, having been ranked number one in the world. And at the end of the article is such that we don't know where it's going to go yet. We don't know how this is going to land. And someone who was listening to the sermon then had, or on the archives, wrote me a note and said, "Boy, you know, we listened to your sermon, heard your example. I'd like to refer you to another tennis star of a generation ago and how differently the circumstance turned out." It says, Andrea Jaeger turned pro in 1979 at age 14, was ranked second in the world at age 16, before being forced from tennis by injury at age 19. She took all her income from tennis and has spent it and her life since then helping children who are dying of cancer. Her money has run out and she now depends on the support of others. She has a ranch called the Silver Lining Foundation, and her story was told on ESPN a couple of weeks ago. What a contrast to the image that is presented by so many of the other athletes today. And I did. I looked it up, and I was reading the story, the foundation, and the way they bring the kids in with the cancer and give them an opportunity to progress. And so she spent all of her winnings with another lady that she combined with to make this foundation, spent their personal savings, all their resources, and now they live off themselves of the donations that come in to support this project and their ranch. Now, that is an incredible contrast to so many others in our society today. The difference, I think, is this. When you dedicate your life to something that is greater than you, when you focus on what it is that you can contribute and serve and produce, that is an element of showing emotional and spiritual maturity. It is give versus get. It is outgoing concern instead of selfish focus. And it is what spiritual maturity must always be. So we live because God called us, and we are together as a congregation and as friends because He has put us in this place. And He's called us to be fruitful and to increase. Again, going back to the commitment that we make first to God is in baptism, the greatest commitment we make in this life. Probably the second greatest commitment we make will be marriage. But whether we marry or not, whether we never marry, whether we are as Jesus Christ or as Paul, who did not apparently, in Paul's case, have that relationship, there's some question. The fact is still, we must develop and we must mature, both spiritually and emotionally. And it comes down, again, to looking outside of ourselves and contributing to others, to seeing something greater than ourselves, and to being committed and absolutely established in that support. God gave us His church. He gave us His work. He gave us each other to care for and to nurture. And He says, "These are my disciples." Effectively, they will be fruitful, but they must also be spiritually and emotionally mature.